This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, Houston's hidden gem, with a developer-friendly environment and Houston's sixth-largest business center. More information at nnmd.org.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Thanks for hanging out with us and talking politics. Jay, I have talked to all of the living past presidents, and they all say this is the best podcast they've ever listened to. You can fact check me on that if you want to, right?
Yes, because fact checking is what is in now.
That's
right?
In. Okay, the new year, new opportunities.
That's right. Truth matters, facts matter these days. It's a whole new world. 2019.
We're going to talk a lot about the shutdown and the wall and the speeches, and so it's going to be a good recap of what's going on. Hopefully, catch people up. But there's a bunch of stuff happening on the international stage and the domestic stage. So let's talk about the White House and their walk back from their discussion about the withdrawal from Syria. What's going on there?
Well, that's right, Brandon. As you probably recall, Syria was a hot topic. The president had made a really kind of this very quick announcement, almost off the cuff, where he said, look, we're out of Syria. We have beaten ISIS. We're moving ahead. It's now time for the folks there in the region to fight. And it immediately got tremendous blowback from pretty much the entirety of the foreign policy establishment, including not just Democrats, but Republicans as well, and military strategists. Of course, we know that it led to the resignation of General Mattis as Secretary of Defense. And now it's suddenly been walked back pretty dramatically. National Security Advisor John Bolton announced that, hey, we're not going to move out just yet, not until we get guarantees from Turkey that they are not going to attack or get in conflict with our regional allies, the Kurds that are fighting and helping us there.
Yeah, this is a couple things, I think, along the lines that you mentioned. It demonstrates a clear disarray within the White House, and it demonstrates a lack of kind of cohesion in terms of their foreign policy in an area of the world where there needs to be a lot more certainty. So you said Mattis resigned, which is exactly part of that, but also Kevin Sweeney, the Pentagon chief of staff, resigned even after that. The president's chief ambassador for kind of counterterrorism also resigned. So this is an echo effect, which could be seriously problematic. But what's most problematic potentially is withdrawing U.S. troops from an area where they're needed to help to fight ISIS. And almost everybody agrees that they have to stay there at least until there's some kind of plan. It's not clear what the White House's goal here is.
Yeah, I mean, the larger question of whether or not the U.S. should be continuing to have troops in there, whether we even have the legal authorization to do so, I think is somewhat murky. But you just can't announce sort of on a Monday that, it's time for us to go.
Exactly.
I mean, yes, the conflict is long, but there are broader security interests at play here. And the president, I think, just as he's known to do, kind of spoke off the cuff, did it. It's no surprise that President Putin, I think, was the one most happy about this.
Yeah, he gave a speech and it was like, I agree with the president on this. Like, well, yeah, I mean, geopolitically, of course you would, but this is a potential problem here. So I think it's going to be set, the criteria are going to be set. And so Bolton, I think, essentially is outlining these scenarios where we're likely not going to pull back anytime real soon. Well, speaking of sharing, Jay, Paul Manafort, the Trump former campaign chair, is in the news again for reasons which I think he and also Donald Trump would prefer not to be. The crux of it essentially is that he apparently, according to some information which has come out, has met with during the campaign Russian-linked operatives. This individual in particular was suspected to be a member of the Russian intelligence organization. In doing so, shared polling data with this individual and effectively may be another problem for the president and the White House in terms of discussing the role that they played in terms of collusion with Russia.
Yeah, I mean, I think here's what we know, that the drips and drabs coming out of this investigation really paint a picture that there was some sort of concerted effort to, at the very least, keep the members of sort of the Russian government, the Russian intelligence services, apprised as to what the state of the race was.
Yeah.
I will say this, I think we can all agree with this. It is not normal for a campaign to inform members of the Russian intelligence. It's kind of what's going on the internal aspects of a campaign. This is just another example, and I think it adds a certain amount of credibility to the ongoing investigation, an investigation that should be getting wrapped up pretty quickly.
Yeah, unusual, you say, huh, to share information with the Russians on the course of the campaign, right? I think you're exactly right. You know, the Trump's camp sort of constant refrain is that Manafort's misdealings and the fact that he's pled guilty to these things all happened before he became part of the Trump campaign. Well, now you have evidence that he was doing similar kinds of things during the campaign. It also suggests that Manafort's opportunity during the campaign and his role in the campaign, the timing of the meetings and other sort of information, that maybe there is some kind of collusion. So this information likely is in the hands of the special prosecutor. So we'll see how that plays out. But I think you're right. I think we're nearing the end of this. So we should have a lot to talk about pretty soon.
Well, speaking of that investigation, one of the key figures in keeping it going was Rod Rosenstein. And he was the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. He was a Trump appointee. And he just announced that he is leaving the Department of Justice. Brandon, was he forced out? Is this about the investigation? Is it just timing? He's looking for a private sector job. What does this all mean?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's a little bit of all of the above. I mean, I'm not sure he was forced out. I mean, he was thought to be sort of Trump's ballast against any more push in the investigation. I think the problem for the White House is that this ratchets up concern and maybe elevates some of the controversy about William Barr, who is likely to be the next attorney general, assuming that the Senate confirms him. So it's going to, I think, put a lot more pressure on him to identify exactly what he plans to do in terms of the investigation. But what it tells me, I think, is that really this is probably the case that the investigation is ending, and Rosenstein probably felt like it was a comfortable time to leave, especially when there's so much other chaos happening in Washington.
Yeah, that's my take as well, that he recognized that the investigation itself is nearing its conclusion. Yeah. And I suspect he probably didn't want to be around to have to deal with this underlying issue.
Right.
Because we don't know what the investigation is going to tell us. We also don't know what the conclusions are going to be. But either way, he's going to be left, I think, sort of in the middle. And I think it probably is wise, particularly since he's been on record as essentially not being able to, I think, full-throatedly defend the president on this.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, he'll be on a beach someplace when the report comes out. And there's still a question as to whether or not, you know, DOJ will turn over the stuff to the Congress and the degree to which there's going to be interactions there. So there's a lot, I think, to negotiate even behind the scenes. So we'll figure out how that all plays out. But there's been some interesting developments, including Donald Trump, but not exactly involving him on the impeachment front. Incoming representative from Michigan, Representative Rashida Tlaib, the first Palestinian-American congresswoman in the country, had some very specific words about what they would do to President Trump. Now, would you like to...
For the benefit of our audience, we will note
this is a family podcast. We won't repeat exactly what she said, but let's just say that it was very specific and very choice.
That's right. To quote our former governor, Rick Perry, who used this exact term, which is a sort of contraction of it. She basically called the president of the United States a mofo.
A mofo.
And in a discussion related to impeachment. And there's sort of two issues. Aside from calling him that, she basically came out and said that he needed to be impeached, that there were enough evidence out there now to call for articles of impeachment. Mm-hmm. As we just talked about, the investigation itself, while it may be nearing the end, hasn't been concluded, and you haven't actually seen the evidence. It's making some folks really question, I think, how she's approaching this. But more to the point, and I think this is the one that's what's getting everyone sort of riled up, even on both sides, is whether it was appropriate for her to use that kind of language.
Right.
I'll say, look, the world as we know it, when it comes to using that language, is completely changed. We all know the president has been known to drop an F-bomb or two.
Not innocent on this.
I think the only issue here for Representative Tlaib is she did this on tape, and it's now out there. And
exactly.
It frankly did it in front of her 5-year-old son.
That's a little much, right? Yeah. From a parenting perspective, maybe you choose something different here. I had a professor in college. He was a legit Black Panther. He would use the term Maryland farmer, and that was... about as far as maybe a congressperson should go on this, but she got repudiated from all kinds of sources, including from Nancy Pelosi, who said, she didn't appreciate that kind of language. But it's, I think the more important question is really the sentiment, right? And she admitted that it was a distraction. And I think that's really the problem for the Democrats, is how far to go on this. Because if it looks like the new Congress is going to be reactionary, then it's going to, I think, hurt the case. If it ever comes to the point where they do want to have a legitimate articles of impeachment. The president's response to this, I thought, was really interesting, too. He says, you know, how can you impeach a president who's the most popular Republican of all time and who is the most successful president after 2 years in office? So, I mean, we're through the looking glass on this, I think, generally anyway. So I don't know if the language is the issue, but certainly the kind of strategy in terms of impeachment is really still part of that question.
Well, speaking of through the looking glass, we're going to have to sort of look at tea leaves here, Brandon, because the Supreme Court of the United States has essentially sort of opened something back up that we thought was done.
Right.
As you know, there was a previous case out of Michigan and Wisconsin looking at the question of partisan gerrymandering that the Supreme Court essentially punted on.
Yeah.
Well, they've just now decided to take up a new round of cases on the question of partisan gerrymandering. Brandon, what's going on here? What's going to happen?
Yeah, lower court rulings coming out of North Carolina and Maryland effectively suggested that gerrymandering is a problem. Partisan gerrymandering is a problem. I don't know why they didn't settle this in the Wisconsin case. They essentially sidestepped the larger issue about, you know, whether or not it was the case that partisan gerrymandering was an issue. So I don't know why they didn't settle it then. Maybe they'll settle it now. My sort of expectation was that they were going to set some pretty clear guidelines, but they didn't. Maybe they're looking for just the right case to do it. So that's an issue. But the problem remains, right? You've got essentially politicians who are picking their voters. And as a result, it's, I think, undermining the kind of compromise that we otherwise might see because everyone is so partisan. That's part of the reason that we have this sort of current shutdown we have.
Right. And this is one of the reasons why you've seen this move nationally for individual states to adopt nonpartisan or independent commissions to draw lines. And all of the instances we've mentioned, Maryland and Pennsylvania previously, Michigan, Wisconsin, and North Carolina, they are legislators essentially drawing lines for members of Congress and for themselves. And so this is part of that larger issue you have.
Yeah. Well, it's not all about, you know, Supreme Courts and legal determinations and troop withdrawals. Members of Congress can have fun too, right, Jay?
Yes, and it doesn't matter when they have it, because apparently we live in the age of the internet. Nothing ever dies.
Right. The outrage never goes away.
Yeah, and the outrage, especially when it's misplaced and just stupid outrage.
Right. So what we're referring to is a video of a dance I am sure you've seen multiple times. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is the incoming freshman representative from part of New York that represents the Brooklyn and areas in Queens, has... Somebody had uncovered a video of her dancing to, I guess, a recreation of the scene in the Breakfast Club where they're all dancing. And what was assumed to be like an unflattering portrayal of her has really, I think, endeared her to a lot of people, right? So it kind of backfired.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of an understatement. I mean, it went viral. There's an entire sort of Twitter handle on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez dances to any song.
Oh, right. They put different songs to it.
Yeah, they put different songs to it now. I mean, and it's, I think the best description of that video, it's a cute video. It is a sort of hype video for her college at Boston University, and I think was largely well received. The interesting thing to me about this whole deal is that it reinforces that for whatever reason, the conservative establishment, or really the most conservative parts of the Republican Party, are bordering on kind of a near obsession with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Yeah. No matter what she says or does, it seems to create this sort of viral effect.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, for lack of a better word, she's a freshman member of Congress with very little institutional authority or power. She is sort of the definition of a backbencher, represents kind of a sliver of the Democratic Party that itself is not in power. Yet she has sort of captured their minds to the point where they just constantly want to talk about her. And the interesting thing to me is this. Why would you engage on social media to essentially go after someone on social media who is a millennial who, by definition, are the masters of social media?
Right. It's like when the skateboarding Beto was released, right? People were like, oh, look at this guy skateboarding. Well, people loved it, right? It shows
right.
He's fun. He's got a personality. He likes to skateboard. It's not a big deal. But I think you're exactly right. The politics behind this are really interesting. The Republicans would love to have her keep talking because every time she says something, they take it out of context or they use it in a certain sort of framed way or misframed way that takes a point the Democrats on the far left are looking for and essentially inculcates that into the centralized role of what the Democrats are trying to do in Congress. So it's a potential problem for the Democratic Party as much as it is for her, but she's definitely a lightning rod.
Well, Brandon, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Texas. We've got a lot going on here in the Lone Star State.
Yeah,
the session started.
That's right. Pomp and circumstance. Everyone's happy for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, you know, it's always the euphoria of the first day.
Right.
But by day 140, they are pretty angry at each other.
Right. Literally fist fights, right? We'll see how it plays out.
Well, let's start off with kind of a couple of interesting things that popped out, at least to me. We had Senator Charles Schwertner, who is a member of the Texas Senate. He was embroiled right before the election cycle started in a pretty significant sexual harassment claim that was made against him by a University of Texas graduate student. It was investigated, and the whole matter, I think, to say it was not settled is being kind.
Yeah.
Sort of this mysterious third person came in and essentially took the blame for it. Nobody knows who that person is, using Schwertner's phone. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing has cast a cloud on it. And he, I think, essentially decided he's going to take a step back, relinquish his chairmanship.
Yeah, this is a pretty big deal. I mean, being a chair of one of these committees, especially Health and Human Services, is a fairly prestigious position. So this is something which is not inconsequential. Well, speaking of wrongdoing, Representative Ron Reynolds from Missouri City was released from a Montgomery County jail after serving about 4 months of a year-long sentence just before the session started, Jay.
Yeah, this is one of the strangest things I think I've seen, at least in more recent years in politics. Representative Reynolds was jailed on a misdemeanor charge. He was actually given jail time for a misdemeanor, which almost never happens.
For barratry, right?
For
this
barratry,
is basically
right.
Like, almost like ambulance chasing, right?
Essentially. And the underlying facts around that are a little bit murky. Mm. He essentially didn't. It's also related to the repayment of money that he should have paid to one of his clients. The amount of time that he spent in jail is kind of unprecedented. He timed it himself so that he could essentially go and be done before the start of the session. He walked out of jail without much fanfare. I think it's been reported he didn't have anyone there to pick him up.
Oh.
But he went straight to Austin, and lo and behold, he's been filing bills left and right. It's in some ways kind of, I think, invigorated him politically.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting. My take was like, well, normally you like go from being in a legislative session and then go to jail after that. This is the reverse. So this is kind of a new take on it. It's interesting. Yeah, it's a rare event, although there's been so many great scandals in the sort of legislative history of Texas that this is certainly one for the ages. But what was interesting to me, and I'd forgotten about this, but that Ronald Reynolds is one of the most delinquent members of the legislature in terms of filing the required campaign finance and personal finance disclosure forms. He's filed just 3 of these reports since February of 2016. So that's not why he was in jail, but it illustrates that the Texas Ethics Commission has very little teeth to enforce these things.
Well, Brandon, we talked about this. The Texas legislative session, the 86th, is now open this week.
Yeah.
What's going on in the Texas House? We got a new speaker. What have they done that in the opening minutes?
Yeah, well, first of all, we're rich, right? Texas.
That's right.
Has got a lot more money to spend. The comptroller released reports that said that the amount of money available is about 8% higher than it was. So that leads to about $120 billion in potential general revenue for the next 2-year budget. The rainy day fund's up to about $15 billion. This is a lot of money, but there's a lot on the agenda, right?
Yeah, lots of priorities here. The number one being, of course, school finance. There's about $9 billion out of the general fund for this biennium that really have at play here. And the $15 billion that you have in the rainy day fund,
That
combination, because that rainy day fund we know is a little overfilled right now. But we know we've got 3 big priorities. We've got school finance. They want to do tax reform. We still have issues related to health care because of Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. We've also got issues related to paying for Harvey.
Yes.
That is a huge deal still out there.
Yeah.
Can they do all of this? It's going to be a challenge. We know that the Commission on Public Education, on Public Education Reform, rather, for on the finance side, came out and said they're recommending they want about a $1.75 billion. You've got experts saying you need about $5 to $6 billion to kind of make the system whole. You'll probably, I think, land somewhere in between. You might get some level of tax relief, but probably not the kind of tax relief everybody wants, mm-hmm. at least to full extent. The rest of it, I don't know. I mean, we've seen energy prices already falling, and that's where most of this comes from. It's going to be an interesting session.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and as you say, the expectations are really high, and I'm not sure they can meet these expectations, right? You're talking about, like, reforming the school finance system, right, which has been in place for, what, how many years? Since the 90s, right? You're also talking about redoing property tax reform, somehow identifying caps on that, which the governor has said is going to happen. I'm not sure that those are mutually, like, exclusive. And I think it could be a real problem to, you know, kind of do them both together. So in terms of expectations, they're sky high, and it's going to be really rough. I guess the good news is that the big three seems to be on board. I mean, they had a press conference, right, a couple days ago that had them essentially singing kumbaya, saying they all agree that school finance and property taxes are all on the agenda. They even wore the same suit. I think they all went shopping together at, like, Joss Hay Banks. If you look at the picture, it's like they all have that same kind of blue suit on. So, I mean, they're all on the same page right now. But, I mean, is it going to last?
Oh, it never lasts. As I said, I mean, we're in the honeymoon of the session, and everyone's excited, and everyone, as you say, sort of singing kumbaya. But we know that the Senate and the House historically will have some level of friction. Dennis Bond is a different, he's a different kind of speaker. He is much more aggressive and much bolder than I think Joe Strauss would be in terms of just being very forthright with, he will absolutely not do certain things. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Yeah. I'm optimistic. He's made school finance a priority. Yeah. I think that may be the one thing they do get out of here.
He gave a speech today that said that, you know, he'll kind of, after this meeting is done for the day, after they gavel out, you know, he'll walk up and down the aisles and he'll pick up trash that people have left because he wants to leave the place better than he started it, which is a very admirable goal. And it occurred to me that there's a lot of trash that was left over from last session. So he's going to have a lot of work to do. But but think of the people who nominated him, right? Matt Krause, who's the golden boy of the Freedom Caucus, Lyle Larson, who's been a kibitzer of the governor. Like, he, I think, is positioning himself to have the House play a major role and even challenge Dan Patrick on some of these big school finance issues and property tax issues. Remember, you know, Bonin was somebody who sided with Strauss on the property tax issues, like having the cap like a little bit higher than was expected. So I think we're going to expect to see a lot of friction. I mean, they all agree on what we should talk about, but I don't think they agree on exactly what should be done.
Well, Brandon, one thing I know for certain is you might be the only man left in Texas who does not have a beard.
That's right. We have some interesting video evidence of, yes, Beto O'Rourke is alive and well in El Paso and is apparently growing a little beard.
That's right. Beto O'Rourke decided to grow a beard, and the internet exploded, Brandon. You know, I mean, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, right? You have like 300,000 people watching him fold his clothes. When the fact that he grew a beard has turned into a thing. And, you know, this back and forth between Beto having a beard and now, we talked about Ted Cruz's beard.
Right.
That has its own life and made Ted Cruz warm and fuzzy, I guess is probably the best way to describe it.
Okay.
But the internet is notably mixed as to whether or not Beto looks good in a beard.
It's a harsh world we live in, right? People are judging your facial hair. Now, when was the last time we had a president with a beard, Jay? Can you even remember?
Oh, God.
I mean,
Grant is the one that's most famous for having the beard.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of kind of what he's going for.
Last president with facial hair would have been before the, you know, 1920s, right? So it's been almost 100 years since a president's had facial hair. So I don't know if this is the right move for him if he wants to be president, right?
Yeah, true. You're right about that. But, you know, beards are definitely in now. Scruffy looks in. So maybe it's not the first time Beto has caught on and been part of sort of popular stuff.
Hey, normally he's setting a trend, and this time he's following it. So I don't know. Where's the Beto of old, right?
I know. The original Beto is gone.
Original Beto.
Well, Brandon, the big fight, of course, has been over the wall. We've got essentially federal government that has been shut down. 800,000 people, federal employees, affecting everything from the TSA, our ports of entry. We've got subcontractors in and around NASA. We've got people saying that we are weeks away from our parks being left looking like a garbage dump because the garbage hasn't been picked up in it. Four people have died at our national parks as essentially lack of people kind of watching it. No more park rangers. It is actually reached kind of a critical juncture. We think about it as only taking place in Washington, D.C., but the federal government reach is national. This is a big deal. What's going to happen? Are we ever going to get it settled?
Yeah, are we ever going to have a government that functions again? It could be a little while. Let's talk first about the speech. Now, this was a kind of primetime address, the first for the president from the Oval Office. I thought that the speech kind of fell flat. It's clear that Trump's trying to rally his base. That's he's good at. But I think beyond that, his goal here was to make sure his members stayed in line. I think the real fear for the White House isn't so much that his base will leave, but that the Republican members of the House and Senate will leave. Trump was fairly passionless in this. I thought he lost his zing. My take is that like the White House could be doing better at this. I don't think they can win this, but I think they could do better at this, and they're simply not. But I'm not sure the Democrats are doing that much better. We had this kind of awkward parent Skype with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer where they had so many flags and such a small podium where they kind of finger wagged the president for saying what he did.
Yeah, it was. They had this visual of like, you know, your parents catching you staying out too late and they were scolding you.
You came home late and they were.
Just sort of lecturing you. I agree with you. The president was flat. Now, on the follow up issue, you know, he's trying to do that. He's coming to Texas.
Yeah.
He's in McAllen. He's with Dan Patrick. Patrick, our lieutenant governor, was apparently advised him a little bit on this speech.
He skipped the opening day.
He skipped the opening day of the legislature to do that. I'm not sure how effective any of it is. You know, this is one of those rare times where sort of semantics and the framing of a subject is all this is about. The president wants to be able to leave with some sort of victory, some sort of barrier.
Yeah.
And essentially, the Democrats don't want to give him that.
Right.
And the public is with them. Overwhelmingly, the wall is unpopular.
Yeah.
It's not popular with independents, and it's certainly not popular with Democrats. It is deeply unpopular with anyone who represents the border. Will Hurd, the congressman who represents about 200 miles of the Rio Grande Valley area, the largest swath of it, he voted with the Democrats and is against the president on it. Everyone you talk to says, yes, we need border security. Yes, we need smart technology at the border, but we don't need a physical wall or concrete-based wall there. The president's insisting on that, and he's now sort of pulled back, saying we need some sort of barrier. Steel slats is this kind of new mantra.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure how this gets resolved unless you can figure out a way for both sides to have some level of face-saving, or Mitch McConnell finally says, let's end this nonsense. The bill that the Democrats just passed in the Senate that was Republican-controlled 100-0.
Right.
the Republican Senate can essentially open up government because they can override the president anytime they want on this if they want to.
Right. Well, what's not going to get it done is the sugar diplomacy the president's engaging in, right? Apparently during a meeting he had served M&Ms and Skittles and Butterfingers and then walked out when it was the case that he realized he couldn't get a deal. Democrats don't want to move, but I think the president and the White House has boxed himself into a corner. We talked about this last week. I think that the fact that the wall is like the end-all, be-all has really deterred the movement on the other kind of immigration issues the White House might actually, you know, get some progress on. So what about the issue of the emergency? This is something the president has sort of threatened to do. This is something presidents do threaten, I think, on occasion. And it's a leverage point which they can successfully engage in. But what do you think would be the result if that would happen?
Yeah, so I think the sort of there's two schools here. One, you know, the president could certainly call a national emergency. I think it would be litigated as to whether or not he had the ability to build a wall. I think he would probably win in courts. There's great deference given to the executive in very sort of how you define an emergency is up to the executive. The law is very broad. Both President Bush and President Obama have done it 12 and 13 times respectively. And I think there's an argument for the not even existing, but in fact does. That said, it would certainly get litigated. And I think in the court of public opinion, the president would essentially be roasted on this issue.
Yeah.
I think it is hugely problematic for him politically to try to do this.
Yeah.
And I think it would probably hasten more problems for him. But it's still out there. He could do it. I just don't think he ultimately will.
Yeah. Leaning Republicans are fuzzy on the wall, so I don't think that's a good move for him. And Republicans also don't like the use of this overreach in executive power, so I don't think that's a good play. And frankly, Congress will just cut the funding for it in, you know, next time the appropriations comes around. So I don't think it's a big issue, a good issue for him. I think it's problematic. But we'll see. There's still lots of miles to go between now and then, so we will identify those problems probably next week, right?
That's right. That's right. Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer, who is always bringing us salty and sugary snacks, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our webs and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the audio wall, Holsland.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.
This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, Houston's hidden gem, with a developer-friendly environment and Houston's sixth largest business center. More information at nnmd.org.